where you can get the thing that you're interested in. And we always cue you to the original discovery. This is published in Nature. It was in the May 7th edition of the British journal Nature. Not this one. This is May 13th. I couldn't find my May 7th issue. But what was featured were two stories. One was a technical research paper, but it was of such significance that the editors of Nature decided to do a layman's version. And what's unusual about this layman's version, it was almost as long as a technical paper, trying to explain all the intricacies of what's going on. And the bottom line is this, that geophysicists in Germany have found something in the late heavy bombardment that really factors into the planet being able to support advanced life. So you've heard me speak here in the class about the Mars-sized planet that bombarded the Earth when the Earth was only 50 to 60 million years old, and how that collision opened the way for our planet to be able to support any kind of life. I mean, the enigma of planet Earth is it's got such a thin atmosphere, given its mass and given how close it is to the sun. Its atmosphere should be 100 times denser. But if that were the case, there'd be no possibility for life on planet Earth. On the other hand, if the Earth had a smaller mass and therefore would have a smaller primordial atmosphere, that mass would not be adequate for the support of life. It's the mass of planet Earth that enables planet Earth to retain water for a long time. Mars, for example, being one-ninth the mass of planet Earth, doesn't have the gravitational pull to hang on to water, at least in the liquid state, for a long period of time. It can only hang on to it if it's in the frozen state. And even then, it must be at a very low temperature. That's why we only find long-lasting water on Mars at the poles. It's the only place where it's cold enough where that water won't escape to outer space. But planet Earth has a mass that's large enough to retain water for a long period of time. However, in order to make life possible on planet Earth, it was necessary to rid the planet of its primordial atmosphere so a much thinner one could take its place. And that's part of what this collision did. The collision removed the heavy atmosphere of the primordial Earth, and a much thinner one took its place. In that sense, the timing of the collision was critical. If it took place too early in the history of the Earth, then the atmosphere that would have replaced the one that was removed would have been too heavy. On the other hand, if the collision took place too late in the history of the Earth, the atmosphere that would have replaced it would have been too thin. And what we see in planet Earth, it's got the just right atmospheric pressure, the just right atmospheric constituents to support not just primitive life, but advanced life. But even primitive life would have been impossible if this collision didn't take place. But the second blessing of that collision, there's several, but a second blessing is that what happened in the collision is that heavy element material in the collider was absorbed into the core of the Earth, and the light element material formed a debris cloud around the Earth that condensed to make the Moon. That's one thing we notice about the Moon. It has a lighter constituency than the Earth, and the Earth, thanks to this collision, is the densest body in the solar system. So it's got the heaviest element composition of any solar system body by a fair margin. Now, it's that heavy element constituency that enabled planet Earth to have a large core, and a large core that would sustain a magnetic field for a long period of time. Because what happened was the Earth got an extra dose of iron, nickel, and cobalt, the magnetic metals that form the a key component of a dynamo in the core of the Earth, but it also picked up a lot of uranium and thorium. And uranium and thorium is the energy source that drives the dynamo of planet Earth. And so we've got the magnetic metals we need to drive it to make a big enough dynamo to sustain the magnetic field, and then there's the uranium and thorium which provide the energy source. And that uranium and thorium is also responsible for driving plate tectonics. And that's two requirements for long-lasting life of planet Earth, is that it have a magnetic field that would persist for 4 billion years, and it would have plate tectonics that would persist for 4 billion years. It's the plate tectonics. I won't go into the details, but the plate tectonics is what enables the Earth, along with the creation of just the right life forms at just the right time and just the right amount and diversity, to compensate for the sun getting brighter and brighter. Without plate tectonics, there'd be no mechanism to bury carbon dioxide and water that's taken from the atmosphere through the agency of life and converted into sands and carbonates and converted into coal, oil, and natural gas and get this stuff buried in the crust of the Earth. So it's the removal of carbon dioxide and water from the atmosphere, the greenhouse gases, into sand, carbonates, coal, oil, and natural gas that allows the greenhouse effect of planet Earth to decrease in exactly the right amounts to compensate for the sun getting brighter and brighter and maintain the surface of the planet for light. Now, what these German geophysicists did was they compared Mars and planet Earth. Now, in the case of Mars, it at one time had a magnetic field, and it also at one time had some plate tectonic activity, but it rapidly shut down. And the reason it rapidly shut down is it had a much smaller magnetic core, or a core made up of ferrous metals, iron, nickel, and cobalt. Those are the metals that are easily magnetized. Mars has a much smaller amount of that stuff in its core, and it has a much smaller amount of uranium and thorium. And therefore, its magnetic field shut down almost right away, and likewise, its plate tectonics shut down right away. And that did not happen to planet Earth. Yes. It does not have a magnetic field. It's possible it had a magnetic field in the past. It's also possible it had plate tectonics in the past. There's a lot less we know about Venus than we know about Mars. It hasn't received the interest that Mars has from the space science community because it's well known that it's got an atmosphere that's 40 times denser than we see here on planet Earth, and that immediately makes it a non-candidate for life. And so it hasn't really attracted the interest of the astrobiology community. Although there are a few astrobiologists that think that there might be conditions in the high atmosphere of Venus that might be conducive for the maintenance of bacterial life. In fact, I've argued that it might be good to send a probe into the upper atmosphere of Venus and look for Earth bacteria. Because, you know, 26% of the ejecta from planet Earth winds up on Venus. So there's a lot of Earth material floating around in the Venetian atmosphere. And if you go there, you should be able to find at least diatoms. Because diatoms have a high probability of surviving a trip across interplanetary space to Venus in such a form that they would remain intact. I mean, if they don't come into the Venetian atmosphere, they're not going to burn up. That's probably the best place, even better than the surface of Mars, for finding the remains of Earth life. Because it's not going to get damaged much by the trip there. But there's been some interest in the astrobiology community. However, there's really no interest on the surface of Venus because of the fact that it's 800 degrees on a pleasant day at the surface of Venus, and that's not going to be conducive for any imaginable life form. Yes. Yes. Men are from Mars and women are from Venus, so... Well, women do claim to know more about men than men claim to know about women, so maybe that really does fit. So, yeah. Okay. If Earth did not have the collision, we would anticipate that the Earth's atmosphere would be about 2.5 times denser than the Venus's atmosphere. Earth has a bigger mass. Because it's got a bigger mass, it's going to retain a bigger primordial atmosphere, but the biggest factor of all is that Earth is farther away from the sun. So the farther you're away from the sun, The less of the atmosphere will be evaporated by the heat of the sun, and the bigger the mass, the more gravity. Actually, it's the gravity, not the mass. But because Earth is both denser than Venus, and it has a bigger mass than Venus, the gravitational force on the surface of Earth is substantially more than it is on Venus. Therefore, you're going to get a heavier atmosphere. But with an atmosphere 100 times denser than what we have here right now, you can forget about trying to breathe. In fact, once our atmosphere gets about 3 times denser than what it is on the surface of the Earth, the lungs no longer are that effective. Well, now just to take it a little bit further, I mean, you know, people who do scuba diving, when you go down underneath the water, what you do is you come up with more air pressure to balance what's going on in the water, but there's a limit. And therefore, I mean, if you go down really deep, then you're looking at several atmospheres, and you can sustain that for a short period of time, but you simply can't live under those conditions long term. So you've got to come up to the surface and get back to the way the atmospheric pressure is. So lungs can tolerate about a factor 3 up or down. I mean, that's why you get into trouble when you're on top of Mount Everest, because the atmospheric pressure is only about a third of what it is here at the surface. And, you know, there have been stories of guys who've climbed Mount Everest without oxygen. However, they stay up there a short time. As long as you don't spend a long time on top of Mount Everest, you'll be okay. You spend too much time up there, you die. And that's what's happened to people. After, if you've been up there a couple of days, the chances of death are quite high. That's just because, you know, the atmosphere just isn't very dense, and your body gradually dies. In fact, I talked to a guy who had been up there, and he said every hour you can feel your bodily strength dissipating. Every single hour you can see yourself going down. And therefore, you really try to get off the top of that mountain quickly and get down to an elevation where conditions aren't so bad. Anything above 26,000 feet, you experience that slow death. So it's not that slow. Hours literally make the difference. But hey, let's get back to the story. What these geophysicists were talking about was not the first bombardment of planet Earth, so what's called the late heavy bombardment. And the thing they noticed in looking at the core of planet Earth is that unlike the cores of other planetary bodies, and unlike the cores that they would expect from their modeling of the geophysics of the interiors of planets, planet Earth has about 10% by mass of what we call light elements in its core. What I mean by light elements are elements lighter than iron. And the most predominant of those is oxygen. So the core of the Earth, and we're talking the very solid core of the Earth and the liquid core around it, there are significant quantities of sulfur, silicon, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. But these geophysicists were attracted by the oxygen. You know, why is there so much oxygen there? And when you compare it with Mars, for example, what we see on Mars is that its core has virtually no oxygen at all. And likewise, their modeling would demonstrate that we would not expect there to be all this oxygen. And they said, how is it that the Earth's core has got so much oxygen? The other thing they said is, how come it's so big? Because this collision, the first collision that the Earth experienced, this Mars-sized planet being absorbed into it, you wouldn't anticipate that the core of the Earth would grow to the extent that it did. And so they said, we see an extra large core for planet Earth, and we see an abnormally high amount of oxygen dissolved into the liquid part of the Earth's core. How come? And this has been an enigma that geophysicists have been struggling with literally for 30 years, trying to explain this oxygen abundance in the core and the fact that the Earth's core is slightly larger than what we'd expect. Yes. Okay, it's all done through seismology. And so what you do is you create artificial earthquakes. That's basically what seismologists do. They go around the surface of the Earth, and they put charges of dynamite down, 100 feet into the Earth, and they create an artificial earthquake. And then they measure very carefully how the earthquake waves propagate through the interior of the Earth. So, you know, 30 years ago, and I took a course in geophysics as an undergrad, that was probably 40% of the course, was trying to figure out or, you know, study the whole idea of how through these artificial earthquakes you can figure out the interior of the Earth, where the cores are, how the waves propagate, and then you're able to model what kind of composition does it take to explain what you see. Okay. Well, Mars, you kind of do the same thing. You... Well, there's another tool. I mean... Well, actually, what's been done on Mars is something that complements what's been done on the Earth. That's to put satellites around the planet. So if you've got a satellite going around the planet, what you're doing is very carefully measuring the gravitational field of the planet. Okay? And so that will tell you what kind of anomalies, yeah, you can get some modeling there. So if you can get lots of satellites, and that's been done on Mars, I mean, at the Global Surveyor, a lot of the science that's come out of it has been the physics of the interior of Mars. The other thing that's been done is using satellites with magnetometers on board. And so you try to very carefully measure the magnetic field. Now, Mars does not have a general magnetic field like planet Earth does. However, it does have magnetic rocks, both inside and on the surface. And so the Global Surveyor, for example, has been measuring magnetic anomalies. And from that, you can kind of figure out what's going on. What's been remaining, however, is to send a craft on Mars that would put sticks of dynamite deep underground and blow them up and see what happens. You know, that really is only effective if you've got measuring devices to look at these waves, these vibrational waves over the whole surface. I mean, we have that for planet Earth. There's literally tens of thousands of seismographs over the whole surface of the Earth. In fact, this was how back 20 years ago our government could tell whether or not the Russians were cheating on their atomic testing. You know, they had a small little nuclear device that they blew up underneath some Siberian desert region. They could quickly figure it out because all their seismographs would wiggle a little bit and they'd say, aha, there's been a disturbance in this part of Siberia, and it measures the equivalent of a charge that released to 20,000 kilotons. And so they said, that's an atomic device. So, they were until they signed a test treaty. And then what happened is the Russians tried to get away with it by saying, we're going to explode something so small that the Americans can't pick it up. But the Americans could. Even really tiny stuff they were able to pick up. So, anyway, that's just what geophysics is all about. Yeah.
What form is the oxygen?
Okay, well, the form it's predominantly in. I mean, oxygen will, you know, easily react with sulfur and silicon, so you get that kind of stuff there. But what they've been noticing is there's a lot of dissolved oxygen. So just like in the ocean, there's a lot of dissolved oxygen in the ocean. The fish are able to capitalize on that dissolved oxygen and to breathe that oxygen. Likewise, there's dissolved oxygen in the liquid part of the Earth's interior core. And this is really what these geophysicists in Germany were trying to tackle. How do we explain all this dissolved oxygen? And the thing that they came up with is that the only possible explanation is the late heavy bombardment. Now, the late heavy bombardment took place 3.85 billion years ago. So this is when the Earth was about 700 million years old. So the first big event was when the Earth was 50 or 65 million years old, and then the next big one when it was about 700 million years old. In between, there were lots of collision events. But you get a big one early, a single collider hitting the Earth about the size of Mars, and then 3.85 billion years ago, you've got what's called an asteroid rain of terror. And this is where the entire inner solar system is being pelted by big asteroids and comets. And this is fairly well established. When you look at the moon, for example, you see all those craters on the moon, and even the seas on the moon are the direct result of that late heavy bombardment. If you look at the moon through a telescope, and by the way, we're trying to get another star party together, And maybe what's nice is you pick a date. Well, you got to pick a time when it's not cloudy like this, but you pick a date when the moon is going to go down fairly quickly, because you don't want a moon up there to see the galaxies and the globular clusters. But pick up the moon when it's just kind of that thin sliver and it's going to go down quickly. And even with a modest telescope, you can see signs of erosion of the lunar craters. They're slightly worn down. You can tell, for example, which crater is relatively new. There's one big one on the moon that was formed fairly recently. And when you look at the walls of the crater, they're crystal sharp, very sharp. But when you look at the more common craters on the moon, you can see a slight amount of wearing. And that's because the moon has a very small atmosphere. Its atmosphere is almost entirely made up of argon. And you say, how come the moon has an atmosphere? Well, potassium. 40 is a radiometric element, and it decays into argon-40. And so the moon accumulates as argon-40, and the gravity of the moon is strong enough to retain that argon-40. That's one of the ways we have of dating how old the moon is, how much argon-40 is accumulated there. But the moon rotates now once every 29 days, and it was rotating more rapidly in the past. So what astronomers can do is build a detailed model, recognizing the moon did indeed arise from this collision event when the Earth was 50 to 70 million years old, and that the moon started off with a fast rotation rate, and it's been slowing down ever since. And so if you kind of model everything backwards, you can calculate how much erosion you would get. And the answer is the craters we see in the moon show that those craters and the seas formed predominantly 3.85 billion years ago. A second check on that is by looking at the rocks that the astronauts brought back from the moon and dating those rocks, and those rocks testify of a massive event that took place 3.85 billion years ago, an event that would have liquefied much of the surface of the moon. And then a third way is to look at meteorites that come from the moon. There's quite a few meteorites that have been recovered that we know are lunar rocks. So that gives us three independent checks. You can also go to Mercury and see that Mercury also suffered this bombardment. Likewise, Mars. In each case, you got a different erosion rate. And all evidence tells us that there was this late heavy bombardment of the inner solar system 3.85 billion years ago. However, this is kind of humbling when you look at the moon and see all that crater damage. Then you can calculate, given that the Earth has a much stronger gravitational field, what kind of damage would the Earth have taken? And you can look at Mercury and see that it suffered a little more damage than the moon, so you can kind of work things out. The answer is, planet Earth took 30 times the damage that the moon did. So this was a dramatic event. Now what these German geophysicists did is said, what do we need in the way of a late heavy bombardment to explain all the oxygen we see in the interior of the Earth and to explain the fact that the core of the Earth became a little bit larger? And the answer is this bombardment would have to be intense enough to produce a magma ocean on the surface of the Earth at least 800 kilometers thick. So this is a dramatic event. It's not something that caused a little bit of damage. This is huge. And that very deep magma ocean is what permitted oxygen in the atmosphere of the Earth to be dissolved into the interior and go down into the core. It's also what allowed the iron in the crust of the Earth and the mantle of the Earth to sink down to the core and make it a little bit bigger. Now, one of the things these three German geophysicists did not do in their paper was to take it to the next step and say, okay, how much of this is critical for life? And that's kind of what our team at Reasons to Believe did, as we said, no, wait a minute. That oxygen content in the core of the Earth is a critical parameter for whether or not you're going to get life on planet Earth. Also, the size of the core is critical. It's that amount of oxygen in the core, along with the sulfur and the silicon, carbon and nitrogen in the core, that enables, and the size of the core, that enables this magnetic field to be sustained for 4 billion years, and enables plate tectonics to work at a high efficiency throughout the last 4 billion years. And as you've seen in our writings, those are critical requirements for life to be present on the Earth over the past 3.8 billion years. But Fuzz got really excited about this when I was sharing this on our broadcast, because he said, you know what? There's new speculations going on in the Origin of Life research camp that the Hadean era was not totally hellish. Now, what I mean by the Hadean era is that era between the formation of the Earth and the late heavy bombardment. You know, the late heavy bombardment liquefied the surface of the Earth. And because of that liquefaction, it makes it very difficult for geophysicists to get any idea of the physical conditions of the Earth previous to 3.8 billion years ago. And they refer to it as the Hadean era, that era when conditions were so hellishly hot that we really can't have any way of looking at the rocks and figuring out what was going on back then. However, they have found a few zircons, and by the way, this is all covered in our Origin of Life book that we released a couple of weeks ago. Origin of Life researchers have found zircons that have survived the Hadean era. Now, that's no big surprise, because zircons, kind of like diamonds, can withstand high-pressure, high-temperature conditions. Now, not all the zircons survive. A few survive, yes. What's a zircon? Well, you know, if you, it's a substitute for diamond. So if you got a fake diamond ring, it's probably made out of a zircon. Okay, is zirconium? Yeah, have you ever heard of that, cubic zirconium? So it's a crystal, and the crystal's got zirconium in it, oxygen in it. If you want the exact formula, it's in the book. So. I could take a stab at it from memory, but I'd probably be wrong. But it's predominantly zirconium and oxygen. But it forms a very hard crystal, and it's able to withstand very high temperatures and high pressure conditions. And so a few of these zircons are actually recoverable today, where we can date them and say they date to, well, the oldest one that's been found is 4.4 billion years. Okay. Now, if the zircon crystal had liquefied, we wouldn't be able to have anything like that. However, what this has shown, and I write about this in the Origin of Life book, is that there were brief episodes between 4.5 billion years ago and 3.8 billion years ago where the Earth was cool enough that you got liquid water. I mean, during that span between the Mars Collider and the late heavy bombardment, the planet is still being pelted with a lot of giant asteroids and comets. And those asteroids and comets will liquefy the planet frequently. But there will be tiny episodes when it's cool enough that you get liquid water forming. And I won't go into the details. Again, it's in the book. Why analysis of these zircon crystals show us that, indeed, the crystal was at one point cool enough for liquid water could form. Now, the extent of the liquid water is not known. Now, the geography of the liquid water is not known, because we have no idea where these crystals were. They were moving, obviously, when the crust of the Earth was in a liquefied state. However, Fuzz was telling me there's now some speculation that the first life forms didn't form 3.8 billion years ago, but may have formed 4.25 billion years ago, and that these bacterial life forms were able to survive these conditions on the planet and therefore be the progenitor of the great explosion of life we see 3.8 billion years ago. But thanks to this German study, we know that hypothesis has got to be incorrect, because we've not only been able to establish by looking at the physics of the core of the Earth that we're looking at a magma ocean at that time, a minimum of 800 kilometers thick, but also a temperature that exceeds 2,000 degrees Kelvin. And no life form can survive that. And really what Fuzz was talking about is a new discovery where they have found what they call hyperthermophiles. Now, a thermophile is a life form, a bacterial life form that can survive under fairly warm conditions. For example, when you go up to Yellowstone Park, you'll see these pools, and in there there's bacteria, and these bacteria are able to grow quite nicely at 200 degrees. They're able to handle those conditions. Well, what Origin of Life researchers have recently found, just literally in the past couple of weeks, what they call hyperthermophiles. And these are organisms that can handle temperatures significantly above the boiling point of water. Although that's not quite true. What they're talking about are bacterial life forms that reside deep underwater, where the water pressure is really high, and the water is still in a liquid state, though it might be 250 degrees. So it's above the boiling point of water at the surface of the earth, but it's not above the boiling point of water at the place where they're finding the bacteria. And, you know, I've for a long time been saying the really condition for life is not the temperature of the life form, but the distance between the freezing point of water and the boiling point of water. Depending on the pressure, the temperature, the ideal temperature of the life form will go up or down. What really counts is how far away you are from boiling and how far away you are from freezing. And so under these deep sea vents, you're going to get conditions that are quite a bit above. But the speculation is, wow, we found a bacteria that can survive at 250 degrees. Maybe it can survive the Hadean era. But the German study shows that's impossible, because at the height of the late heavy bombardment, you're looking at temperatures in excess of 2,000 degrees centigrade. You can convert that into Fahrenheit. What would that be? 2,000? That'd be about 3,700 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's a bit warm. Yeah, I mean, as basically Fuzz pointed out, that eliminates all speculation. There's no way any possible life chemistry can operate at 3,700 degrees Fahrenheit. That's out of the question. And so what it really does is nail down the fact that the origin of life must have happened rapidly. But to me, what's exciting as an astronomer is to recognize it also establishes that this late heavy bombardment was not an accident. God engineered the solar system in such a way that planet Earth received at just the right time the just right bombardment so that the Earth's core would develop the dissolved oxygen and the size of the core that's necessary to sustain life for the next 3.8 billion years. And it's reaching a point where, as an astronomer, I'm beginning to wonder, are there really any accidents in our solar system? I mean, this planet that collided in the Earth, you said, well, that's an accident. But it's an accident that wound up giving us the fine-tuned conditions that make life possible. And now we're finding that this late heavy bombardment is not an accident. It's got to be just that way in order to make life possible. Yes. That's not known. We don't know how much mass the Earth picked up from the late heavy bombardment. Most astronomers believe that it's not a significant amount in terms of increasing the mass of the Earth. In other words, it's probably less than 1%. So, but I don't know anyone who's interested in trying to calculate that. Mainly what they're interested in is the energy exchange. You know, what exactly happened to the Earth as a result of the collision, and that's what these Germans have been able to calculate. They said, you know, for years we've been trying to figure it out by looking at the Moon, looking at Mars, looking at the Moon, multiplying by 30 and figuring out what's going on. And that gives you a stab at the energy flow, but they're saying a better way is to look at the dissolved oxygen in the interior of the Earth's core and the size of the core. That'll give you a much more accurate number on the energy exchange. And they're basically concluding the energy exchange is much higher than what we thought previously. High enough to indicate that we're talking about a magma ocean, 800 kilometers thick, and of a temperature exceeding 2,000 degrees, and therefore there's no possibility that any life form could have survived that event. Therefore, the origin of life must have been really rapid. And here's how we can tell it must be really rapid. We have very good measurements showing that life was abundant on planet Earth 3.8 billion years ago. You've got this late heavy bombardment peaking at 3.85 billion years ago, and it takes tens of millions of years for the late heavy bombardment to subside, And after it subsides, it's going to take millions of years for the Earth to cool so that you can have a solid crust of liquid water. Well, you can figure it out. 3.85, subtract off a few tens of millions of years, subtract off a few million years after that, and what do you get? Well, you get about 3.8 billion years. So that leaves you a window of time for the origin of life between 3.8 billion years and 3.8 billion years. Again, you can do the math. That's not a lot of time. So that means the origin of life happened quite quickly. And what? And geologic instant, right. And if it's a geologic instant, then there's no naturalistic explanation for the origin of life. You have to appeal to a supernatural creator. All origin of life models presume that we have loads of time for these molecules to come together by chance and make these complex biological molecules. So if you're talking 3.8 minus 3.8 billion years, there goes your time requirement. It's gone. Yeah. That's simply based on the zircons that show us that during the Hadean era, between 4.5 billion years ago and 3.9 billion years ago, there were brief episodes where the planet was cool enough that liquid water could form, at least in some locations. We have no evidence that life ever existed previous to 3.8 billion years ago. They're simply saying that given that there were brief episodes where you got liquid water, possibly there might have been bacteria because they would have had the right temperature conditions for their survival. Right. Yeah, and that's what this thing does. Yeah, it eliminates the possibility that any life that may have existed previous to 3.9 billion years could have survived the late heavy bombardment. Therefore, the origin of life, in terms of life that we can see and measure, must have happened extremely rapidly. And if it's extremely rapidly, then there's no naturalistic explanation. Okay, Cliff, you're next. The sun would, but it would make no significant difference to the sun. The sun wouldn't really notice. Yeah. Okay, that's based on the fact that, you got a bombardment between these two episodes. There's also significant bombardment following the late heavy bombardment. When we look at the Moon, Mars, and Mercury, what it shows us is that the late heavy bombardment peaked at 3.85 billion years ago, and it took 350 million years to subside down to the present level. So between 3.5 billion years ago and 3.85 billion years ago, you still got significant impacts. And Carl Sagan and Christopher Chiba back in 1996 calculated that between the late heavy bombardment and 3.5 billion years ago, you probably have about 30 life extermination events. And so these would be asteroids hitting the Earth with enough force that it would, for a brief time, send the Earth back into this condition where all the water would be turned into steam, and much of the planet would be turned into a molten state, but not all of the planet. Once you get past the late heavy bombardment, you do have rocks that survive. But there's only a few places in the world where you can go where you can find those rocks. Greenland, Australia, South Africa, parts of northern Canada, probably the total geographical land area would add up to maybe the size of New Guinea. These would be rock regions that have survived the events previous to 3.5 billion years ago. So that tells us that there were events on the surface of the Earth that were very destructive between 3.5 and 3.8 billion years ago. Destructive enough that we conclude that we're talking about, these are the words of Carl Sagan and Christopher Chiba, they argued in their paper that we need to start talking about the origins of life, not the origin of life. That there be several independent origins of life, not just one. But after 3.5 billion years ago, you don't have collision events that destroy all life on planet Earth. The most dramatic we know of after 3.5 billion years ago is the Permian catastrophe that only wiped out 95% of all life. Yes. Right. Okay. Early in the history of the solar system, you have many more asteroids than we see today. And today we have three major asteroid belts. You've got the one between Mars and Jupiter. That's the smallest of the asteroid belts. The next biggest is the one after Neptune. Beyond Neptune, it goes out about 2 billion miles beyond Neptune. And the biggest of the asteroid belts is what's called the Oort cloud, which goes from the sun halfway out to the nearest star. However, when the solar system was much younger, there were more belts than just those three, and those three contained a lot more. There were also more planets. And so what happened to one of the planets was it got absorbed by the Earth. But there's speculation that the late heavy bombardment might have been caused by a star coming by close to our solar system and destabilizing the asteroid belt and causing this rush of stuff to come in. There's also speculation that maybe a fairly big body in the Kuiper-Edgeworth belt, that's the one just beyond Neptune, was sent into the inner solar system, probably absorbed by the sun, but as it was scooting through the inner solar system, it destabilized the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter and resulted in all these hits. So that's kind of the scenario. But we do have it well established that it was a significant event that was highly peaked at 3.85 billion years ago. They also have a good measurement of the width of the peak. The width of the peak is about 100 million years wide. So it's between 3.8 and 3.9 billion years ago that you get this late heavy bombardment. But there again, that means that that late heavy bombardment doesn't subside significantly until we see the origin of life on planet Earth. So again, life would be relatively quick. There's a hand here. Well, there are origin of life researchers that are eager to make the window of time as broad as possible for the origin of life. And so, yeah, they look at the error bars and say, how much can we squeeze it? And the answer is about 10 million years. But realistically, it's probably quite a bit less than 10 million years. But 10 million years isn't going to help the naturalists. That's still way too little time to... what we said in the Origin of Life book was a few million years or less. I mean, we're just trying to be conservative. But we also quote a number of geophysicists who make the point that the miracle of planet Earth, that's my word, not theirs, they would say the enigma of planet Earth, is at the very moment conditions are acceptable for the existence of life, we see life. That happens immediately. And so you can read our book. We have several quotes from leading origin of life researchers that say, this is the mystery of the Earth. In fact, it's caused some of them to go so far to say there must be a missing law of physics that we haven't picked up on yet. And what they claim is that there's some hidden property of the physics that makes life intrinsic to the universe and specifically life intrinsic to planet Earth. And I would agree with them. Yeah, there is a missing law of physics we haven't picked up on yet. It goes by the name of G-O-D, so, yes. Well, that is something we've written about, that when you look at the current solar system, it's like everything is just right to maintain stable orbital conditions that will allow life to remain on planet Earth. For example, if the Earth didn't have the moon going around it, then the moon would experience destructive resonances set up by the gravity of the gas giant planets. Thanks to the moon going around it, it breaks up those resonances and prevents planet Earth from being pulled step by step away from the moon or the sun or towards the sun. That's what these gas giants would do. The other thing they've also been able to pick up is it's a really a great blessing, the fact that the gravitational pull on planet Earth is distributed amongst four gas giants. If we had just one gas giant dominating, we'd be in trouble. We'd also be in trouble if the gas giant that did the most gravitational pull on the Earth was not Jupiter. What's really critical is that you want the biggest gravitational disturbance on the Earth outside of the Sun and the Moon to come from Jupiter, where Jupiter has about three times the mass. Then it's also destabilized. It's got to be just three times. The other thing they've been able to figure out is it's really critical that Saturn be the next predominant gas giant planet in the solar system. And it's also critical that we have this Edgeworth-Kuiper belt of comets and asteroids that allows Neptune to have an extremely circular orbit. And if you look up in your little book on the planets, what you discover is that the most circular orbit of all the planetary bodies is Neptune. And that actually is critical for, again, breaking up the resonances that would be set up by the four gas giants. Also, Neptune formed a lot closer to the Sun than where we see it today. So when this late heavy bombardment was taking place, Neptune was significantly closer to the Sun. But because of its gravitational interaction with the Edgeworth-Kuiper belt, it drifted out. And that's also a critical factor for life on planet Earth, is that Neptune drifts out just the right amount and then stops. You don't want it to continue drifting. I mean, it's just incredible. You look at all this stuff, it's got to be fine-tuned. By the way, the very latest on this you'll see posted on our website. I took the time about in April to update our design characteristics for the solar system, because I hadn't done it since May of 2002. So we have an April 2004 list up on our website now. But we've gone from 202 characteristics of the solar system that must be fine-tuned for life to 323. So that's a big step in just the last 2 years. And if you're interested, the odds of finding a planet anywhere in the universe with a capacity to support life has now been calculated to be less than one chance in 10 to the 284. So, you want to put that in context. I got to get back into the Book of Job, but put this in context. Because somebody says, Hugh, what does one chance in 10 to the 284 even mean? And I said, well, think of this. Take the entire observable universe and jam-pack fill it with dimes. How many dimes would you get? We're talking maximal packing of dimes, filling the entire volume of the physical universe. The answer is you'd get 10 to the 84 dimes. Okay? And so just think of the possibility. Take one of those dimes and color it red and randomly shuffle it in this enormous pile filling the entire universe. Your chance that you would pick out the red dime from all the other dimes is one chance in 10 to the 84. And the probability of finding a planet with the possibility of supporting life without invoking divine miracles would be 10 to the 200 times more remote than the probability of picking out one dime from that pile. So it's not very likely. Or to put it another way, it's not distinguishable from the probability of zero. Yeah, you had a question? I'm going to go into Job, right. Sure.
One thing I forgot to mention is tomorrow night is the Skeptics Forum. So 7 o'clock in this room. Be here if you can. Bring some friends or anybody that, you know, that might be interested. I don't see any flyers left, so hope to see you all here tomorrow night. Send the church bulletin. Yeah. So yeah, you know, if you can make a Xerox of that, if you have a friend or somebody, be sure and give it to them. Thanks.
Well, that's tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, right? okay, in this room. There will be refreshments, and please bring anyone who's got questions, Christian or non-Christian, and we'll do our best to try to steer them in a direction and engage them in some meaningful dialogue. Three times in a row, yeah. Okay, Phillips here just said, one way to kind of work out this probability of one chance in 10 to the 284, it'd be the probability of being able to do that experiment three times over. So you got this enormous pile of dimes, you pick one red one out, and throw it back in, reshuffle it, do it again. The probability to be able to do it three times in a row gets you close to that. Yeah, that's close enough. Between three and four times. So the even idea of doing it just once is kind of unfathomable. Okay, Book of Job, chapter 38. And as we've been discussing, what we see here in Job 38 is a reflection of Genesis 1. And we see this several times in the Bible. Genesis chapter 2 is a reflection on Genesis 1, but from a spiritual perspective rather than a physical perspective. And so a few of the items described in Genesis 1 are reviewed in Genesis 2. Here in Job 38, it again reflects on a lot of what's going on in Genesis 1. The thing I asked you to look for in going through Genesis 38 is how it picks up different aspects of the six creation days of Genesis 1 and gives you details. And what's significant about Job 38, it really focuses on the scientific details. I mean, after all, when you're sharing with your non-Christian friends about this amazing creation account in the first page of the Bible, in the 21st century, you typically get into discussion on the scientific details. Genesis 1 doesn't give you all the scientific details. You're going to find a lot more of the scientific information in Job 38, Psalm 104, and Proverbs 8. But one of the exercises that's fun to do is go through those three creation texts, Job 38, Psalm 104, and Proverbs 8, and see how it reflects the six creation days. Now, the one that does that most explicitly is Psalm 104. In fact, as you go through Psalm 104, you can basically see all six of the creation days laid out. Not necessarily in the same sequence as you see in Genesis 1. Genesis 1 is giving you a strict chronology of the physical events. That's not the case in Job 38, Psalm 104, or Proverbs 8. But they do reflect on the events of these 6 days. Psalm 104 does it most explicitly and most extensively. Job 38 does it less so. Not all of the days of creation are reflected in Job 38, but many are. And particularly the first few creation days 1, 2, and 3, are laid out in significant detail in Job 38, and likewise Proverbs chapter 8. But one of the things I brought up last time, it's like the Lord seemed to anticipate that in the 21st century, we Christians and a lot of non-Christians would dispute the interpretation of the first three creation days. I mean, that's really what's going on. You look at what's taking place inside the church and the debate on creation. The debate predominantly is in the first four creation days. Less debate on creation days 5 and 6. And I'm wondering if the Lord didn't anticipate this and therefore he gave us three additional creation accounts in the Old Testament that to specifically reflect on these first three creation days. So as we study all of this, we can resolve our fights and conflicts, make peace, and then get on with the more important task of sharing this information with non-Christians and bringing them to faith in Christ as Creator, Lord, and Savior. And last week I also mentioned that there's a fourth text in 2 Peter chapter 3 that gives us some details on these initial creation days. Now, of all the things that Christians fight about in terms of creation theology, probably the interpretation of the flood is at the top of the list. In fact, when we went through Genesis 6 to 9, we spent a lot of detail, a lot of time going through those four chapters and trying to understand what it had to say. But I'd like to suggest that these four additional creation texts really settle once and for all the debate over the extent of the Genesis flood. Was it global, covering the whole planet, or did it only wipe out humanity and the birds and mammals associated with them? And again, the text that's most explicit is Psalm 104, but you can also argue from Job 38 and Proverbs 8 that it supports what we see in Psalm 104, that the flood of Genesis and of Noah's time could not have been global in extent. Now, let me take you to Psalm 104. Starting in verse 5, and talking about God, O Lord my God, you are very great. That's verse 1. And then you get into verses 2, 3, and 4, and it's talking about creation day 1. It's talking about the creation of the universe and creation day 1. How the, I'll just get into it. He wraps himself in light with his garment. He stretches up the heavens like a tent, lays the beams in his upper chambers. And it's basically talking about the initial conditions of planet Earth. God creates the universe. There's light up there, but it's dark on the surface of the Earth. And Job is going to be addressing this too, the darkness on the surface of the Earth at that time. And then there is light. Verse 5, he set the Earth on its foundation. It can never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. And so the waters are like this garment above the crust of the earth. But at your rebuke, the waters fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took flight. They flowed over the mountains. They went down into the valleys to the place you assigned for them. And as you cross-reference this with Genesis 1, it's clear that it's referring to the events of creation day 2. You set a boundary they cannot cross, verse 9. Never again will they cover the earth. And so there you have an explicit statement that the waters that the God had assigned a place for, oceans relative to continents, that after that event, creation day 2, never again would these waters cover the whole surface of the planet. Therefore, you can safely draw the conclusion that Noah's flood cannot be global in extent. Okay, what does it say in Proverbs 8? Again, it's not as explicit, but it does say things like, I was there. This is wisdom. Again, this is a beautiful passage you could go to for the doctrine of the Trinity, because you see God talking to himself about the creation of the planet that he did for preparing humanity, preparing the earth for humanity. I was there when he set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizon on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above, creation day 2, and fixed security the fountains of the deep, creation day 2. Verse 29, when he gave the sea its boundary so the waters would not overstep his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth. And so what it's saying here is the sea in creation day 2 was given a boundary that the waters would not overstep. So that's not as explicit as Psalm 104, but certainly supports the interpretation we see in Psalm 104 that the flood waters could not cover the extent of the earth. Let me get to Job 38, and then we'll deal with questions. Job 38. Who shut up the sea behind doors? Verse 9. When it burst forth from the womb. When I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness. So you know, there's your reference to the fact that indeed the primordial conditions of planet Earth is that there was light in the heavens, but it was dark on the surface of the waters because the clouds were a garment that wrapped the waters in thick darkness. Verse 10, when I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place, when I said, this far you may come and no further, here is where your proud waves halt. So I think based on Job 38 and Proverbs 8 alone, independent of Psalm 104, you can draw the conclusion, in preparing Earth for the eventual creation of humans, God established, quote, a boundary, or fixed limits, that's a quote, or doors and bars, there's another quote, for the oceans that, quote, the waters could not overstep. And then that would be consistent with Psalm 104, that this is a barrier that the waters never again could overcome. Comment. Right. Yeah, this would be post the late heavy bombardment. You know, Fuzz and I argue that Genesis 1 places the origin of life either at the beginning of or during the first creation day. So that phrase, let there be light, and it talks about how waters covered the whole face of the earth. I would interpret that as liquid water. So we place the origin of life at the beginning or during creation day one. So that would be place the late heavy bombardment before that. Or you can put it in this context. Genesis 1-2 talks about the earth being formless and void. And a late heavy bombardment, I think, would fit that interpretation of being unfit for life and empty of life. So not until after the late heavy bombardment would God be creating life. Yeah. A big liquid glob of 800 kilometers of magma that's formless and empty. Okay. Did I see another hand? Yes. Well, there's been a lot of debate about the fountains of the deep, because that shows up again in the flood account, where God talks about the waters coming down from the heavens, and virtually every interpreter and recognizes that's a reference to rain clouds. So it was rain falling from the sky in the troposphere. But in addition to that, the waters of the flood were bubbled up from these fountains of the deep. And some have said that's only a reference to artesian wells. Others said it's referring to more than artesian wells, that there might have been seismic events that would have pushed ocean water into the Mesopotamian plain. Or it might have been a seismic event which would have allowed a lot of geyser water to come to the surface of the earth. You know, all of that would fit within the context of what the fountains of the deep could mean. So how broad the term it is or how narrow it is, I would say we really don't know. However, in this text, I think you'd be forced to interpret it quite broadly. It's really referring to any water within the crust of the earth or the magma of the earth that was pushed to the surface of the earth. It could. Well, I think it's more than just springs, because the source of spring water is water falling on the mountains, running down the mountains, going underground, and pooling up at some point at the base of the mountain or some shelf partway up the mountain. I mean, you go into the San Gabriel Mountains here, there are springs, but those springs are fed entirely by precipitation. Well, it says the fountains of the deep, so most interpreters are thinking this is more than just spring water. It's water that's actually within the crust or the magma of the earth that's pushed to the surface. Kind of like what you would get in Yellowstone Park. Probably, but it wouldn't be limited to just spring water. Right. And in the land of Israel, you had both. You got geyser water and spring water. So they probably included it all with that phrase. Okay, yes. Yes. I mean, if you were to ask me, how would young earth creationists respond to Job 38, Psalm 104, and Proverbs 8, they would say, this has got nothing to do with Genesis 1. Rather, this is a reference to the events after the creation text. So that's one of the reasons why I'm encouraging us to look at all four texts, 2 Peter 3, and all three of these in the Old Testament, Job 38, Proverbs 8, and Psalm 104, because if you put it all together, it's very difficult to argue that this is not a reflection on Genesis 1. Right, well, particularly Psalm 104, because Psalm 104 actually follows the pattern of Genesis 1 in giving you a paragraph of comment on each of the six creation days. And then when you go to Job 38 and Proverbs 8, you see more. In the case of Proverbs 8, it's referring to what God did in ancient times. You know, it talks about these age-old hills. I mean, we can actually get into it. We're going to spend some time on Proverbs 8. But Yeah, here it is. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, before his deeds of old. I was appointed from eternity, from the beginning before the world began. So, you know, that's a clear reference to the fact that, hey, what's following here is talking about the beginning. We're not talking after Adam and Eve are created. We're talking much earlier. And when you look at Job 38, and by the way, God's got a lot more to say in Job 39 and 40 and 41. What he's focusing on in challenging Job and his four friends is, you know, this is what I did in preparing the planet so that you could exist here. Again, the context puts you before humanity. And God's trying to impress upon Job all the wonderful things he did to make human existence even possible. And I'd say the same theme is in Proverbs 8, the same theme is in Psalm 104, and therefore it'd be difficult for a younger creationist to argue this has got nothing to do with Genesis 1. And by the way, when they do that, they always isolate one text from the other. I've yet to hear a younger creationist take on all four of these extra Genesis creation accounts. They'll simply isolate a few verses from Psalm 104 and say, that context by itself is not adequate to establish that this is a pre-flood event. But you look at the rest of the psalm, I would argue it is adequate. You look at what you see in Job 38 and Job 39. So you get a cumulative case that would make it quite difficult. And then when you combine it with what we talked about last week in 2 Peter 3, where it refers to the flood, I think it's verse 6, and you see the qualification there. Yeah, verse 6. By water also the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. And I would argue that is a reference to Noah's flood. But what you see there is that Peter is careful to qualify it. It says the world of that time was flooded, making a distinction from the world of the Romans when Peter was writing. And the phrase there in the Greek, as we mentioned last week, is tote kosmos. And it literally means the world at the time the event took place. And so Peter's trying to clarify, look, I'm not talking about the world we have today. I'm talking about the world at the time the event took place. Different world. Just like Paul, the same Paul, said of the Romans, your faith has been heard throughout the whole world. The world of the Romans was the Roman Empire. Not the whole planet, the Roman Empire. But the world of the people of Noah's generation was much more limited than the Roman Empire. Yeah. Yes, that's what it says, Proverbs 8. Okay. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, before his deeds of old. I was appointed from eternity. In other words, yeah, exactly. Before there was time, before there was a universe. Okay, who's speaking here? There's some debate over who is speaking. I mean, what it says at the beginning of Proverbs 8, does not wisdom call out? And so this is the person who's being identified here is wisdom. And so a number of Bible interpreters have said, okay, which of the three members of the Godhead would be most consistent with the title wisdom? And they've argued the Holy Spirit. And just like you see in Genesis 1, there's another reference to Genesis 1. It talks about the Spirit brooding over the surface of the waters, bringing about life on those waters. And so here we see that same spirit being addressed here. And what you see in these Old Testament creation accounts is a clarification that all three members of the Godhead were involved in creation. I mean, the New Testament tells us that the one who was actually performing the handiwork was Jesus Christ. The second person of the Trinity was the builder. However, the Father was the one that gave the building plans for the second person of the Trinity to carry out. And then this text is making it clear it wasn't just the Father and the Holy Spirit that were, probably the Father and the Son that were involved in the work of creation. The Holy Spirit was there too. And it's making the point all three were involved in this creation act even before the universe began. Go back to eternity past. Go back to before the beginning. They were involved. They were planning this all out. This would be a great text you can go to establish the doctrine of foreknowledge and predestination. God had predestined everything that we would see manifested in the earth and the universe even before space and time existed. Yeah, we're out of time. Questions? quick. Well, good question, Charlie, and I'll be brief because of our time being out, but probably the thing that's been most predominant is a recognition. Wow, this is much more marvelous and miraculous than I ever dreamed of. That's kind of the theme of Job 38. Is here are these five men, debating one another about how great God is. And then God steps in and says, you've only seen the tip of the iceberg. It's much greater than what you've been talking about here. And, you know, as we've been dialoguing, say, with young earth creationists, with framework hypothesis proponents, that's what I've seen come out of it, is a recognition from both the framework group and the young earth creationist group, wow, this God is much bigger than we thought, much more marvelous. And, for example, we estimate that at least half of our volunteer apologists are people who have come out of the young earth creationist camp. Sure, very much so. And likewise with the framework people, they said, you know, we had no idea that you could defend the chronology of creation events in these texts in the Bible. This is much more powerful than what we thought in the past. And what it really does is it gives people much more motivation to share this stuff with their non-Christian friends, because we have much more ammunition here than we realize. Exactly. Well, let's pray in that context. Father in heaven, we do appreciate that you are a far more awesome God than anything that we could possibly study or imagine or come up with. We thank you for the little bit that you've revealed here in these creation texts in the Bible. And Father, I pray that you'd give us the humility to recognize your majesty, your magnificence, the extent of the creation miracles that you've performed in our behalf. We thank you for the privilege of living in the 21st century when we can even recognize your miraculous hand in something like the late heavy bombardment. And we know there's more to come. You're a marvelous God, Lord. We appreciate the privilege of learning from you. In Jesus' name, amen.